from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour, Senate leaders Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell met over the weekend and will take stock of what is likely, if anything, to come out of those discussions. We'll also discuss latest efforts by House Republicans in the White House to negotiate an end to the government partial shutdown, and that's all coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. With the United States government partially shut down since the 1st of October and default just days away, the U.S. Senate met in special sessions yesterday. And as you just heard on NPR News this afternoon, a meeting is expected between the president, the vice president, and majority and minority leaders. What's going to occur as a result of all this, and what's the prospects for getting us beyond the present impasse and avoiding the October 17th default is what we will focus on in this opening hour of Forum. And joining us here in studio is David Mark, who's editor-in-chief of Politics, an online community focusing on national politics. He's also former senior editor with Politico. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
I also want to welcome Heidi Presbella, who's joining us from the nation's capital, congressional reporter for Bloomberg News. And welcome, Heidi Presbella. Good morning.
Thank you. Good to join you.
Glad to have you. And let's start with what we just heard over NPR News. What's the buzz or what's the thoughts about the meeting this afternoon on Columbus Day between the president, the vice president, majority and minority leaders?
Well, this is how this always plays out, which is that we run out the clock until the last minute, and then the grown-ups get in a room and they cut a deal. So I think, you know, we're getting closer here. Everybody realizes what the consequences would be of not coming to some kind of a solution. And what we've been told is that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has privately made another offer to Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, which presumably will be the subject of these talks later today, that would basically reopen the government until December, extend the debt ceiling until next year, and set up some kind of a framework for broader talks. You know, I think we're getting closer here. There's still other things that the Republicans want. There was a lot of talk about, for example, the medical device tax, repealing that. That's unpopular even with Democrats. Also setting up some income verification rules for Obamacare. But the Democrats at this time are saying if Republicans want that, they're going to have to give something more. The important thing here is that Democrats have dug in a bit on the spending levels, which, you know, only a week or two ago, they were willing to go with the sequester or the automatic spending cuts that were passed into law, which go even deeper in January. They pulled back from that late last week and said, no dice. We want to cut a broader deal that would replace that. And if we agree to your sequester spending levels, to the current law sequester spending levels, we won't be able to do that. So this agreement, I think that's one of the important things to note about this potential offer, is that it would allow them to cut a bigger deal that would then replace those spending cuts.
I guess yesterday the common wisdom had it that there was actually substantive movement. At least that particularly was what Harry Reid had said, although Mitch McConnell was more guarded in his remarks. But it came down in many people's minds to how many weeks to fund the agencies and how long to suspend the current federal debt, the ceiling, that is, of $16.7 trillion.
Right. I think we're really down to a pretty narrow topic band of topic here. If you think about where we started, which was with the Republican demand to basically defund the president's health care law, we're not even fighting anymore about what the main conditions were when the Republicans first picked this fight. So, you know, at this point, you know, I really believe that what it's down to is finding what is going to be the best face-saving solution here for both sides so that Republicans can walk out of this and say that they also got something. And then, of course, you know, this is also the narrative of these deals, is that we never solve the problem. We always kick it forward. And so that's what's going to happen here, is that, you know, they'll set up some kind of a framework for a broader deal with some kind of a deadline, presumably. I doubt if they put any kind of enforcement mechanism on it to force themselves into it again, because that was disastrous. disastrous with the super committee and the sequester. But, you know, we're looking at now another round of negotiations over the same sticking points that have bedeviled both sides ever since Republicans took control of the House back in 2010. And I just, you know, sorry, but call me a skeptic. I've been through it too many times with these guys. And
it's Groundhog Day.
Yeah. Well, at this point, if you look at it, you know, what's been happening over the past few years is that we are tackling the debt, but we're doing it in baby steps. You know, with the Budget Control Act and the sequester, we're taking nips here and there. And I don't believe that we'll ever get a grand bargain, at least with the current political makeup here in Washington. We're going to continue to do that. The thing that's different about this time is that this time we have cut discretionary spending so deep that there is no one I talk to, even the most fervent Tea Partier, who thinks that we can go much further on that. We've got to go after the entitlements, and that's going to be political pain for both parties. So even if it's a small deal, it's going to be more politically difficult to navigate and to for both parties to kind of sign on to going forward. But that's where they got to go.
Heidi Presbella, again, is with us from the nation's capital. She's a congressional reporter for Bloomberg News, and David Marks, editor-in-chief of Politics, is here in studio. And David, the Democrats seem to have the upper hand here, according to polls, and they're using it as leverage. But on the one hand, you have, people like Susan Collins, who put forth one of the proposals saying they keep moving the goalposts. And then you have the Republicans saying they're only offering a reopening of government and temporary assurances against default. So they seem, I mean, according to Heidi, there's probably going to be a deal worked out, but they seem to be pretty far apart still.
Right. They really are speaking different legislative languages here. And I think how Democrats are setting themselves up to look like the compromisers is by agreeing to the sequester level of spending that expired on September 30th, about $986 billion. They're going to say, we wanted to stave off more cuts, but we're being reasonable here. We're willing to go along with last year's total. So that's sort of how I see this going forward. But I think this has been one of the problems of the House Republicans' negotiating strategy along, in that House Republicans could have essentially gotten a deal along those lines several weeks ago.
They missed the boat. Huh?
Right, without shutting down the government. And yet now they're probably going to get a similar deal. And it's going to be Democrats who end up looking reasonable here without compromising on anything to do with the Affordable Care Act, like the medical device tax or verifying information about applicants for the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. I still suspect Democrats are not going to sign off on something like that in the end compromise.
Well, the Republicans have really failed to unify around a common negotiating position. I mean, that's been a problem all along, but we keep talking about the talks that went on, and they were substantive between Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, pretty much compelled by Lamar Alexander and Chuck Schumer, because those two have a good deal of acrimony between them. And actually, I think McConnell has to worry about being reelected. So there's a lot of political mix in this as well. But the House, I mean, how do they get the House involved in this, particularly when there's been this pretty solid position from the Tea Party?
That's an excellent point. All these talks that we've been noting going on between senators, Mitch McConnell, Charles Schumer, et cetera, still do not involve the House, who are the quote-unquote deciders here, as George W. Bush might say. They have real leverage. The Senate talks are among elites, the House of Lords, as they're often seen over on the House side of the Capitol. So there is no assurance at all that any agreement even reached between Mitch McConnell, Harry Reid, and others in the Senate would be taken up, agreed to, even voted on in the House of Representatives.
In fact, Heidi, let me go back to you on that. It would seem that there's been a lot of talk about John Boehner wanting to maintain his position and all of that. He's still being hamstrung, isn't he, by the Tea Party?
Well, absolutely. I don't think that the Republicans, including Boehner, ever realized or ever thought that this would happen in terms of Obamacare, that they'd have to take it so far, you know, to the brink. But, you know, I do think that, you know, Boehner will be in these talks later today with the president. If you look at the history that's been occurring over the past 6 months or so, with the last debt ceiling increase, with the fiscal cliff agreement, with the Hurricane Sandy aid, is that what happens is Boehner, you know, fights the good fight. He goes to the mat. And then at the end of the day, when it comes down to the crisis moment, what does he do? He takes it to the floor and passes it with Democratic votes. And so I think, you know, that's been the prediction of a number of moderate Republicans long ago, that, you know, on the CR, for example, that ultimately he'd have to just capitulate and take it to the floor with Democratic votes and fight for another day over the debt ceiling. I think in this case, you know, everything's kind of gotten rolled into one big mess here. And so what they'll do is he'll take it to the floor with Democratic votes with the promise that they have set up a framework for a broader discussion on the issues that really should have been at the center of the Republican demand in the first place. They went on this great diversion off on Obamacare that they knew was not a fight that they could win.
And at this point, David, Mark, they're really the one down in this, aren't they? I mean, from any perspective, the Republicans, that is.
Right. And this is what's called going off message or stepping on your own message. It's ironic that this is all occurring just in the weeks after the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare has really taken effect, after the exchanges open up, the websites, which have had been plagued by a series of real problems. This actually might have been an opportunity, if you want to look at it that way, a political opportunity, at least, for Republicans to take aim at the deficiencies of Obamacare and some of the problems with rollout and made that their message, and they'd be in much better shape. Now they look like they're on the hook for a potential default of the federal government, which is unprecedented.
So what do you suppose they want? When we speak about they, we're speaking about maybe 20 members of the House of Representatives who happen to be the members of the Tea Party. If they've pretty much no longer see Obamacare in the mix, or that is stopping it as really part of their strategy, I mean, we had Chris Matthews on last week, and he said, well, you know, the Koch brothers, they want suspension of the Keystone Pipeline. They want all kinds of things. But what can they really get out of this?
Yeah, I don't think they're really in a position to make those kind of demands, and they never have been all along. At this point, it may be partly personal. You hear members talking about disrespect, being disrespected on their side of the aisle, that sort of thing, egos being involved here. It's not clear what they want. And it's also worth noting that John Boehner, the House Speaker, could probably survive a coup attempt against him from the right, even if he goes through and passes a big deal with mostly Democratic votes. There probably are not enough House Republicans who would actually vote to topple him and oust him from Speaker and end his current job.
You think his speakership is safe then? Because Lindsey Graham was talking about how it has to be protected and all of that.
Through the end of 2014, after the midterm elections, that's another story. But at least for the next 14 months or so, he's probably in good enough shape to hold on to his leadership job.
David, could you talk a little bit about the White House's role in all this? I mean, President Obama said they won't negotiate until the government reopens and the debt ceiling is raised.
The White House has held remarkably firm on this, and they see a broader principle about not negotiating with the proverbial gun to their head, saying that passing appropriations or spending bills, raising the nation's debt ceiling, those are routine legislative affairs that should not be held hostage, in their view, to extortion. And they say they're standing on broader principle here. And they also have the votes on their side. They have Senate Democrats. The last time there was a big government shutdown fight, 1995-96, Republicans held the Senate as well. So it was Bill Clinton against both United Republican Congress. It's a different situation this time around.
Let's get you, our listeners, involved in this. In fact, we'd like to hear from you and your thoughts about the ongoing struggle to get past this impasse and where you see it going and what your concerns are, your anxieties, your fears, and your hopes, if you'd like to bring those to the fore here. We would like to hear from you. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786, and we do invite you to join us in the conversation, and we welcome, again, your questions or comments. Again, toll-free, you can join us whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite at 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Heidi, where's the pressure coming onto Congress? And, you know, I've been reading this weekend about China's concern and China talking about de-Americanizing, I think was the way the word was translated, about the IMF and Christine Lagarde getting in the World Bank and so forth. I mean, how is that influencing the global picture influencing Congress?
Well, I think that they're all well briefed. There's been several, ambassadors from the administration and from Treasury and whatnot who've come in to brief some of these bipartisan groups that have been trying to work on a solution. And most of them understand the consequences. I think the problem is not that they're not listening to these so-called outside forces. It's more that when you talk to these members of Congress, you talk to Republicans, they say, look, I came here to elect the people of my district who I represent, and they think I'm doing the right thing to fight this fight over Obamacare. And you talk to Democrats, they say the same thing about their constituents, that the position that they're taking, no compromise over the health care law, and that, there should be no conditions attached and whatnot to reopening the government, that is the position their constituents want them to take. And you know what? They're right, because I talked to one Republican, Scott Ridgel, who is like one of the few moderates who's kind of been out there front and center, and he said, look, we basically gerrymandered ourselves into this. The districts now are so packed with conservatives or liberals, Democratic or Republican districts, that the biggest concern of a lot of these lawmakers is not that they'll get a challenge from across the aisle from someone who's angry or pointing out how they didn't work in a bipartisan way to get things done in Washington. It's that they'll get a challenge from someone on the right or someone from the left and within their own party. So when you think about the basic core instincts that drive most lawmakers in terms of self-preservation, they're really doing what the people who elected them came here to do.
Let me bring our callers on. We go first to Morali. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Great program. Thank you. My comment is, again, very similar to what your last speaker said, which is 20 guys from gerrymandered districts are essentially undermining our fundamental method of governing, which is majority rule. So 20 guys in a small majority in one house holding the country ransom with the complete understanding that they cannot be punished for this because they come from completely gerrymandered districts and they're just servicing their narrow interests.
I think the caller has pretty much described, David Mark, the situation. I mean, they are all 20 of them in gerrymandered districts. They have nothing to fear except, like maybe Heidi said, a move from the right or the farther right.
Well, I wouldn't use the term like ransom or arson because those are both illegal acts. And what they're doing are within the rules of the legislative process. I happen to think it's a not very smart approach. I would even use the word a dumb approach because they have no leverage and they're bound to lose it. But they are acting within the rules of the House. What's missing here is that leadership on the part of Speaker Boehner and his leadership team, Eric Cantor, the majority leader, Kevin McCarthy of California, the majority whip, who have it in their power to override those 20 or so members and go in a different direction. And again, I suspect that's what they will do, but only at the last minute.
Let me thank the caller. We'll get more of your calls in a moment. I want to go, though, to Sacramento. H.D. Palmer is Deputy Director of External Affairs with the California Department of Finance, and he joins us to sort of give us some help in understanding how this is all having impact here in the state. H.D., good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be back.
Let's talk about, I'm looking actually at an article here by Will Kempton. He says the shutdown is threatening California's transportation future, not only in terms of projects, but just in general.
Well, we did a survey right before the shutdown happened on October the 1st to determine what programs were going to be affected and what would be paid in the absence of a continuing resolution, in other words, during a shutdown scenario. A number of programs are going to continue to receive federal funding. For example, benefits for unemployment insurance are going to continue to be paid. Money for Medi-Cal, the state's Medicaid program, providing health care to 1 in 5 Californians. Things of that sort, grants to the aged, blind, and disabled, about 1.3 million Californians are eligible for those. So in the short term, the impact of state programs is relatively minimal, but I'll get back to that in a minute. But the issue is the longer this goes, the more questionable funding will become next month for certain programs. A couple of examples. Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, what used to be called food stamps. Roughly 1.9 million households in California are eligible for those benefits. There's sufficient funding, what's called carryover funding, from the federal government to ensure that those benefits will continue uninterrupted for the remainder of this month. as we sit here on October the 14th, we can't make that same guarantee for the entire month of November if this drags on past the end of the month. Somewhat similarly, school nutrition programs. On average, on any given day in California, about 4.5 million breakfasts and lunches are served in California schools. Again, enough money to get it through the end of October. November is questionable. So the longer this goes on, the more questionable funding for some programs like that will be. And I want to – well, I said a minute ago, Michael, that the short-term impact on state programs is relatively minimal. I don't mean to suggest for a moment that there aren't real immediate impacts. You have federal workers in California who have been furloughed for the last 14 days. You have communities surrounding the national parks in California whose incomes and livelihoods depend upon park visitation. They're feeling an immediate pinch in things like canceled reservations. So while a lot of state programs aren't feeling an immediate impact, people in California certainly are.
Well, the longer this goes on, bottom line you're saying is the more vulnerable people are going to be hurt and the more the state's going to be hurt. What about, since you just mentioned the state parks, I mean, they're, for example, in New York, keeping the Statue of Liberty open with more local funding and revenue that's not necessarily coming from the Fed. We looking toward those kind of possibilities here?
We're not. We have no plans to front state dollars to reopen the national parks, and that's for a couple of reasons. First of all, when we passed the budget back in June, we indicated that while it was in balance, it was balanced by a very narrow margin, and a number of risks or pressures existed to the budget that could knock it in the wrong direction. We're staring at two of the biggest ones right now. One, the shutdown that has already occurred in Washington. And secondly, the threat that Congress will not raise the debt ceiling by this coming Thursday, which has a very significant threat to the state's revenue picture. That's not just our view, but also one that's shared by the legislative analyst. And second, even if the state were to decide to forward federal funds to reopen some of the national parks in California, there's no guarantee that the state would be reimbursed for our, if you will, out-of-pocket costs. I think it's fair to say the Obama administration would say that it's their hope and intent that states would be reimbursed for any costs, whether it's for national parks or any other program, that they would put forward in the absence of federal dollars. The executive branch on their own cannot guarantee that states are going to be reimbursed for those costs. That takes an act of Congress. And so it's for those reasons that we are not providing those state dollars to reopen the national parks.
Talking to H.D. Palmer again, who's Deputy Director of External Affairs with the California Department of Finance, what happens if there's a default?
Well, that's scary territory. We've never been there before. And the reason that would have a significant impact on the state budget is twofold. Number one, the overall economic impact could lower our projections. And secondly, from a revenue standpoint, California has a very progressive tax system. We have a very narrow band of taxpayers who contribute a significant amount of state revenue. Some numbers to go behind that. If you look at the most recent data from the Franchise Tax Board, 1%, just 1% of all of the personal income tax returns that were filed in California generated more than 41% of all of the personal income tax that was paid in the state. And unlike most individuals whose income is derived from wages and salaries, a lot of the income from that very narrow band of taxpayers comes from things like capital gains and stock options. And if we get into a situation where we do pass the default deadline and the markets have what many expect to be a severe negative reaction, that could have huge impacts on the state's revenue system.
Oh. Well, we're coming up on a break. H.D., thank you so much for joining us. That's H.D. Palmer.
Thank you, Michael.
Deputy Director of External Affairs with the California Department of Finance. We'll continue, and David Mark will stay with us. We have to say goodbye to Heidi Brisbella, whom we appreciate being with us, and you can be with us as well. Again, our toll-free number, should you care to join us, and we invite you to do so, is 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. If you have thoughts, questions, comments, concerns about the threat of a shutdown and the debt ceiling, we're talking about the federal government and the possibility of its opening for business. We'll talk about the politics some more, and we'll hear from you. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the ongoing impasse of potential of the partial government shutdown, that is, and also what is being done and what can be done. We spoke earlier with Heidi Brisbella of Bloomberg News. David Mark of Politics is with us. We also spoke to see what is happening here in California with H.D. Palmer from the California Department of Finance. And we're going to go to your calls and emails. I wanted to bring Public Radio's political junkie and former political of NPR, political editor of NPR, National Public Radio, Ken Rudin on. He's in Washington. And, Ken, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. And I thought we'd get your perspective on this. Democrats are getting default off the table, maybe, and apparently are unified, unlike the Republicans. And so they seem to, at least according to consensus, now have some real leverage here.
Well, they do. And the question is how far they want to take it. Do they want to punish the Republican Party or do they want to get a deal? I know we're talking about there's two different subjects here, and that's understandable given the fact that it's Washington and Congress. But one is politics. And if we're playing politics, then, you know, look, Harry Reid never liked what the Republicans did to shut down the government to begin with. They didn't like the stuff about cutting down Obamacare. And even further, you know, when the Republicans took control of the House in 2010, the negotiations between the White House and the Republicans in Congress over the debt ceiling and things like that didn't go the Democrats' way. So perhaps Harry Reid is somebody with long memories and would like to just maybe exact a bit of revenge.
Yeah, it's come down to maybe the Democrats punishing the Republicans. That's what I'm deconstructing you're saying.
Well, I mean, look, the fact is, everybody, even the Senate Republicans didn't like what was happening in the House, except for Ted Cruz. But there were some, I don't know if you want to call them adults in the room, but there were some adults who said, well, look, you know, shutting down the government is not the way to express our disappointment and dislike for the Affordable Care Act. You don't shut down the government. You don't inch towards default. You basically negotiate. Now, when you only control one body of Congress, and that's the House, you can't have everything your way. But I think that, you know, look, we've seen President Obama negotiate, and a lot of Democrats have said that he's given more than he should have over the years. And there are people like Harry Reid who would probably say, look, no more of that. Then, you know, they made us look bad in the past. It's time for us to, you know, make them look bad. But of course, you know, there's a difference between trying to help the country and help and better the country and better the process. And there's a thing called politics, too, and both play a big part in it.
Well, and the Democrats are still angry over the sequester, I think it's safe to say. But the Republican senators are distancing themselves from the Tea Party strategy. And you have to ask how this is going to play out in the House of Representatives. If it's no longer about Obamacare for those 20 congressional representatives who do hold suasion, what's it about?
Well, that's a very good question. And your guests earlier were talking about that very well, the way they were talking about it. The point is the House Republicans are no longer playing a role in this. We were talking about maybe Paul Ryan would come to the rescue because Boehner can't control his right flank and blah, blah, blah. So Paul Ryan would be the consensus choice to negotiate for the House Republicans. But the House Republicans don't even seem to be a part of this. Once again, as we've seen with the fiscal cliff negotiations at the end of 2012, it's the Senate Republicans and perhaps Mitch McConnell who are going to come to the rescue. And, you know, we talked about this compromise that Susan Collins was offering over the weekend and the Democrats in the Senate rejected. Well, the Democrats in the Senate also know that if they're going to alienate Susan Collins, then they're not going to get any of the other Republicans as well. So perhaps maybe they feel that they may have gone too far. But the whole deal, it looks like from right on, will be decided in the Senate. And then, of course, the big question is that once the deal is decided in the Senate, what does John Boehner put on the floor of the House, and how does his party respond to it?
Are you optimistic about a deal?
I am. You know, something I keep thinking, I've been reading about all the henny-penny, the sky is falling, all that stuff. I'm looking at the Dow Jones Industrial right now. It's down 30 points. If people were scared that this was going to be the sky is falling, the end of the economy as we know it, well, then I think Wall Street would be even more and more frightened. So once again, it's typical Washington. We're down to the wire. We're down to the last few minutes. But ultimately, I think that, you know, a deal is going to be there before Thursday. Now, of course, the question is for how long, and if it's like 6 months, do we go through this battle all over again? And my suspicion is yes.
We've got Ken Rudin with us again, Political Radio's political junkie and former political editor for NPR. Can you stay with us, Ken?
I sure can.
And we have David Mark, of course, editor-in-chief of Politics, which is an online community focusing on national politics. He's former senior editor with Politico. And let's go to your calls, and let's get Alex on here next. Alex, you're on.
Hi. So the last time we had this game of chicken with the debt ceiling, our credit was downgraded just by the prospect of it. Interestingly, everyone went to run and buy U.S. bonds as the safe haven. The only person I hear talking about that issue is Rand Paul, who says it was just coincidence that our credit was downgraded in the wake of that fight last time, and it was really because of our outstanding debt in general. I don't hear anybody talking about the threat of our credit getting downgraded again, and if this time, maybe people won't be running to buy U.S. bonds.
Yeah, response, David Mark?
Yeah, that's actually an excellent point, and we're already starting to see a little evidence that there is concern in the market. Some treasury bills, some of the big banks have sold off treasury notes in the last few days or so, not at a massive level, but just kind of a warning. It kind of reminds me of that scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark where the Germans are playing around with the Ark and it starts burning through. It starts giving a little warning signal that, hey, this is serious stuff you're dealing with here. So I think we are dealing with real serious economic ramifications. It is worth noting, though, that Treasury Secretary Jack Lew has been a little coy on precisely what would happen on Thursday, October 17th. I think it's possible there could still be accounts that could be moved around, shifted from one place to another. So it might not be catastrophic beginning Thursday, but I don't think there's a whole lot of leeway left here.
But isn't speculation the key here?
Well, sure. And that's what markets hate, is uncertainty. As Ken noted, the Dow Jones is only down by a small margin today. But I do think the closer we get to that self-imposed deadline of Thursday and imposed by the Treasury Department, the more uncertainty there is, the more problems it creates.
And let me thank you, Alex, for the call. I want to go to more calls in a minute. But Ken Rudin, a listener named Raphael, writes in an email asking what you think party activists like Ted Cruz will spin for this compromise in a way that doesn't alienate Republicans should one be developed. And I think it's a good question, particularly in light of the fact that Mitch McConnell's got a tough race ahead of him, and he's got to spin this to come out of it in some way that looks good.
Well, I don't think Ted Cruz really cares what it's going to do to the Republican Party. I think a lot of it has to do – the fact is that Ted Cruz – is either looking at 2016, which is very possible, or the fact is, as I've heard earlier on the show, that many of the House members said, look, we were elected in 2008, 2010, and reelected in 2012 because we promised that we would, you know, shut down, we would basically make the government not as large. We'd obviously decrease the size of government, limit the scope of the size of government, and that's what we were promised to do. You could talk about redistricting, you could talk about all that, but a lot of people say, look, we are true to our principles, and so, you know, maybe the Republican Party will be hurt in the 2014 midterms, maybe they'll never win the presidential race in this, you know, the next 100 years, but as long as these members keep getting reelected back home, and they keep to their a promise about, you know, smaller government, then there's not that much of a worry. But there are more people in the Senate side of the Republican Party who says, look, you know, we're going to take a beating. We have an opportunity to get Mitch McConnell to be making the majority leader after 2014, and we're just really hurting this. All you have to do is just take a look at the polls.
We go to more of your calls. Gary, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, the current Tea Party kind of reminds me of some echoes of the past when the Preston Brooks in 1856 of South Carolina beat the nearly murdered the abolitionist Charles Sumner, and this is when the Southerners actually started the war of the Civil War because of such differences within the two parties.
Well, there are some people on the left who are saying they want to secede in Texas. Let them secede.
Yeah. Well, you know, the interesting thing also, this political scientist Juan Linz, who just passed away, he wrote that America was kind of an interesting country because our democracy system, presidential democracy system, actually worked because we had people that were, you know, we had Republicans that were conservative, moderate, and liberal. We had Democrats that were conservative, moderate, and liberal. And that's the way you keep a democracy working. But when you have one party that did not win the election and is demanding its agenda be put in place, they really are holding the country hostage. And it's actually quite frightening. It's something that usually hasn't been done in the past when one party, especially these 20 freshman congressmen they're freshman and sophomore congressmen who have an inordinate amount of power. And unfortunately, we don't have people like Tip O'Neill as, Speaker of the House anymore that can actually get a deal done. We have John Boehner, who simply has abrogated his leadership role. In the old days, I worked on Capitol Hill in the 70s, and if you were a freshman congressman and you pulled this kind of stunt, you weren't given any good positions in the different committees. You weren't you watched and listened and gained experience. And this is I found very frightening to hold it and hold it. I don't think President Obama can actually he can't compromise with these people because they'll do it every single time if you compromise with them.
Okay, we get the point, and we thank you for the call. And well, David Mark, they've got a safe face too, don't they? These Tea Party members in this.
Well, in a way, they would win by losing, even if Speaker Boehner does put on a quote unquote clean debt ceiling and spending bill that extends the government. It doesn't default, goes on for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, some short amount of time. They can say we're the purists, we fought the good fight. It's just been baffling to me though that at a certain point, Speaker Boehner hasn't kind of thrown them overboard, because there is about a base group there of 20 to 30 Republicans in the House that don't like Boehner. They don't trust him. They say he was first elected to the House in 1990. He goes back to the old leadership days. He was part of the earmarking crowd, even though Boehner himself has never taken an earmark for his district. They're never going to support him, no matter what they do. A rump group of them tried to actually launch a mini coup against him in January of this year when the new Congress convened. So at a certain point, I do see Speaker Boehner kind of forsaking them and say, well, I tried. I did everything I reasonably could to make these people happy. It's just a matter of when that happens, and time is running short for that.
Can I respond to the caller?
Ken Rudin, go ahead.
Seconds ago, he was talking about the good old days, but in the good old days, he was talking about the liberals, conservatives, and moderates in the party. Both parties had their sense of moderates and centrists who were very anxious to do a deal, talk to the other side. But we've seen in the last several cycles, we've on the Republican side, anybody who's a moderate who smiles at a Democrat will be threatened with a Tea Party conservative challenge in the next primary. And so many of the moderate, so-called moderate Democrats were clobbered, were decimated in the 2010, Tea Party coming to Congress. A lot of the moderate. So basically, the Democratic Party is very left-wing. The Republican Party is very right-wing. And there's no reason to talk, because if you do, you're looked at with suspicion by the other side.
Let me go to some of your emails and tweets here. Gary writes, the Republican Party is rooted primarily in the business community. It is the business community which is feeling the impact from the Republican Party's hostage-taking and this absurd infantile tantrum. Why is the business community not demanding that the Republicans stop the damage from the right flank strategy?
That's a fascinating question about this real split that's emerged between the big business backers that used to be the bedrock of the Republican coalition.
John, well, the Wall Street Journal did come out against this, and so did a number of business leaders on Wall Street and so forth. But
right.
They're still not necessarily, as the caller suggests, coming down as hard and hammering it as they could.
No, absolutely. A lot of these Republican leaders used to be much more closely aligned, it seemed, with big business. John Boehner, for years before he became speaker, would go around saying, I'm a business guy. I understand your needs. He used to run a plastics company before he came to Congress. That other member, Scott Ridgel, a second-term member from, I believe it's Virginia Beach, Virginia, he was a successful car dealer. Somebody like that, you would think, would understand credit markets. What would happen if they dry up, if bond yields go down, all the problems we've been discussing. But for a variety of reasons, business does not have that same sway over at least House Republicans as they did even a few years ago.
And here's a thought from a listener, Ken Rudin, named Bradley, who writes, my first sense is that I am disappointed in the Democrats from the bottom all the way up to the president, because it seems they may have been able to end this current fiscal crisis sooner if they had universally and repeatedly spoken out about the fact that what the Republicans are seeking, as in more changes to the Affordable Care Act, has already been negotiated and ultimately made into law. If the Dems had hammered away at that, wouldn't it have been much more pressure on the Republicans and ended this sooner?
Well, I think the fact is that there's some truth to that, and the fact is that 3 years after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, which was signed by, passed by Congress, signed by the president, upheld by the Supreme Court, basically validated by the 2012 election, and yet President Obama is still trying to convince Americans that it's a good deal. So obviously there's some bad salesmanship going on there. But, I think from the beginning they've said that, this is ours from the beginning. This should be our issue. The Republican Party needs to realize this. But the ultimate stumbling block, the ultimate thing that's keeping the two sides apart, is that the Republicans will not raise taxes and the Democrats are not going to cut entitlements until the Republicans agree to raise taxes. So you could talk about Obamacare, you could talk about the debt ceiling, you could talk all you want, but there are deep philosophical differences between the two parties that's certainly not going to get resolved before Thursday, and it's questionable whether anything gets resolved in the next 6 months or whenever the next time we have to go through this all over again.
May I also say that it probably didn't help the cause of Obamacare with all those mess-ups in terms of the website and all the nightmares that many people have faced?
All the Republicans had to do was keep quiet, not shut down the government, let the Obama administration get embarrassed over all these glitches and these problems and everything like that, and they could have sat back and said, see, we told you.
Well, Tom tweets, I'm afraid the public will forget who caused this. U.S. public has attention span of a hummingbird. There must be a political price paid for this. And, will there be a political price, David Mark?
Well, it's interesting. I think that message gets back to some of the angst that we do hear on the left from some of President Obama's ostensible supporters. They say he was too accommodating with Republicans to begin with, that Obamacare never would have become such a big issue if President Obama had not even tried to negotiate with Republicans back in 2009, 2010. So there's also some concern among the Democratic base, not that they're going to overthrow him. President Obama's been elected to a second term, but the splits don't just occur on the right. They're also on the left. We'll see in 2014. It's pretty tough to turn a House district at this point, though.
Well, apropos of that, I'm looking at a website comment from one of our listeners. Steph, who says, can the guest give us an example of a representative who has been seriously damaged by a challenge from the left? And please leave Ralph Nader out of it. I'm talking reps in the gerrymandered districts.
There actually have been a few. There was a few isolated incidents. There's a guy named Tim Holden in Pennsylvania who took a challenge from the left last year. He represented, I think, the Harrisburg area. His district was withdrawn. There might be – Ken could probably speak to this more extensively. There might be three or four other examples, but not on a mass scale.
Ken?
I agree with that. I mean, of course, there was the perfect example of the female senator from Arkansas who basically had to worry about her left flank, and she was challenged by the left wing and the unions because she was too accommodating to Republicans. And then, of course, she barely survived her primary, had to face the Republican right, which is on its ascendancy in Arkansas. So that's true. I mean, the Democrats don't have the kind of eat-your-own problems that the Republicans seem to be going through now. But once upon a time, there was a growing and vigorous left wing of the Democratic Party. But, I mean, who were the Occupy Wall Street folks in Congress? I can't name a one, whereas, of course, you could name a lot of people who were basically are ready to shut down the government on the right-wing side of this.
Well, you still got Bernie Sanders in the Senate, I guess.
Yeah, he was just reelected. It's hard to get more left than that. He's in there for several more years to come.
And here's Steve, who's with us from Concord. Hi, Steve.
Hi. The lady from Bloomberg was very quick to point out that there's very little left to cut after the sequester has taken place, and she immediately spilled over into entitlements. And I'm wondering, what about the 800-pound gorilla of defense? And then secondly, the entitlement as it is to Social Security is solved instantly simply by removing the cap on it.
David Mark?
Well, that actually raises a really interesting question about a good point about some more leverage that congressional Democrats and President Obama actually do have here in some of these last-minute talks. A lot of House Republicans and Senate Republicans, for that matter, don't want to see defense cut anymore at the sequester levels. That is one area they'd actually like to roll back the sequester. So there may be some more room for discussion in maybe raising some of the defense spending along with other social spending. And virtually every member of Congress represents a military base, some defense contractor, something of that nature. So they all have some incentive to raise defense spending to a certain degree.
Yeah, I want to read a listener comment on our web and get a response from you, Ken Rudin. Joe writes, why is there this idea that there is nothing left to cut? Let's start with a cut to defense back to Clinton-era levels. We are creating huge deficits so we can boss around foreign governments only to create a bigger problem down the line when the people we pick end up to be despots and we have to throw them out. I wish the Democrats would get backbone on this issue.
Well, there were cuts, as David points out, there were cuts in the sequestration on defense as well as domestic spending. And while the Democrats say, we're not going to sign anything, this is Harry Reid's dream, that we don't sign anything until we undo the damaging stuff on sequester. So, I mean, the Republicans can't say, well, we need to restore money in defense without opening up the door for the Democrats to say, well, if you're going to open up money for more defense, then what about all these domestic programs got hard hit for the sequestration? So both look, nothing is going to happen. I have a feeling that sequestration is not going to change at all. The Democrats would love to increase spending. Republicans would love to increase spending on defense issues. But the real, as David said, the elephant in the room is the entitlement programs, the Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, that is just, needs some kind of a solution. And again, it takes profiles and courage, and we haven't seen that much of that in either side of the house, either side of the aisle.
Here's Bradford with a procedural question. Go ahead, Bradford.
What I see is that with a small party, a small segment of a party, being able to control Congress, in other words, we're converting through the back door into a parliamentary system, because there's only 2-3% difference between the parties nationally as it is, so 2% can control it. Why cannot a vote be taken to the floor through a motion of its members rather than waiting for the speaker to actually put the motion through? And if it cannot be, why can it not be changed? If we're a democracy, then our representatives should have the right through some sort of number, whether it's a two-thirds majority, to put a motion on the floor to request the vote. Then there'll be an individual tally on who's continuing to block the opening of the government and who is not. And that would take away the power from one small group to be able to control this situation.
What do you think, Ken Rudin?
Well, that's an interesting thought. I mean, basically, when you think historically, the House is probably more Democratic now than it was in the old days with the, the Speaker Joe Cannon and the, the people who just ruled Congress, just completely roughshod without any influence by committee chairman or the rank and file. Boehner's problem, of course, is that he's almost too afraid to exert leadership because he just knows that he's going to be shot down on the other side. I don't know, I think, look, basically, while there is more democracy in the Senate, there's much less democracy in the House. And even if you have even if you control the House by just a handful of votes, you still control all the goings on. And Boehner's not about to put up something on the House, let anything go for a vote on the House side that could jeopardize his standing even further.
Let me thank Bradford for his question. And since Kent talks about more democracy in the Senate and less in the House, let me go to you on this, David Mark. Tina writes in an email, if Obama negotiates now, the precedent is horrific. He needs to stand firm while Reid and McConnell find the fig leaf. The House Rules Committee change in the middle of the night going into this, preventing anyone other than the Speaker or the Majority Whip from bringing forward a clean CR, was a functional coup that got little notice. The people no longer have a voice, and the long-term health of democracy in our country is at serious risk.
She really hits on an important point there, that there actually have been a few procedural openings for Democrats to try and get a quote-unquote clean spending and debt limit bill on the floor. One is through something called a discharge petition, where if you get a majority of House members, in this case it's, I think, 216 because there's a few vacancies, you can force the House to consider it. That would involve 15 to 20 House Republicans signing on. So far, that has not happened. She's also referring to something that's kind of gone viral online among political geeks, a change in House rules that was cooked up by the House Rules Committee. It's something I used to cover. I remember it well. They meet almost sometimes in the middle of the night to make arcane legislative maneuvers. And in this case, they prevented House Democrats from offering what's called a motion to recommit, which is a long legislative way of saying pushing it back to committee and forcing a vote by the full House on something that they wanted. This did get very little notice. It's been brought up after the fact. That maneuver essentially guaranteed a government shutdown, because that was done in the 8 p.m. hour on September 30th. Had that not gone through, a clean bill could have transpired, and we might have avoided a lot of these headaches right now.
Well, and here's Rick, who writes in an email, Congress should work on real problems like spending, the tax code, and revenue and financial reporting that's realistic. The debt limit is a phony problem that is only to raise cash to pay bills already incurred. Congressmen need to stop grandstanding and posturing and work on real problems. And let me get another caller on from Atlanta, Georgia. Rick joins us. Rick, you're on.
Hi. I am wondering what your speakers think of the argument that President Obama and the Senate Democrats are not willing to compromise, in part because they believe that the House Republicans have, the Republican general, have no credibility to keep a bargain. That is, if they compromise at this point, it will lead to a series of, they will be viewed as weak, and a compromise will really never last. It'll just be seen as a view of weakness. So the only option is to take a stand.
Yeah, bringing up the whole question of trust here, Ken Rudin, if you could.
Well, you know something, Mitch McConnell will say the same thing, and yeah. I think Speaker Boehner said the same thing, that the Democrats have, you know, said they would do one thing. Apparently there was some movement on the Susan Collins compromise over the weekend, and they thought there was something was happening, and then suddenly Harry Reid said, we want more concessions, and that's, you know, going by the wayside. You know, I think both sides really distrust the other. I think the greatest irony of all is that if there's going to be a deal between Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, and the two of them can't stand each other. I mean, there's no love lost at all between both Democrats and Republicans, but there is a big, tremendous amount of animus between McConnell and the Republicans and Reid and the Democrats. And so, you know, the thought of keeping their word is just, you know, both sides are very suspicious about it.
But there's an irony in this. And David Mark, let me get your comment on this. I mean, it used to be that Reid and McConnell could work together. As I said, it took a couple of other senators, Alexander and Schumer, to bring them back together because there's so much animus now. And the same with Boehner and the president. I mean, they used to supposedly be at least kind of amicable toward one another, and everything seems to be going downhill just in terms of civility and getting along.
Yeah, there's just no chemistry between these leaders. Harry Reid is pretty well disliked by Republicans. They don't trust him.
I think you're being kind of saying pretty well disliked. He's hated.
Yeah, that's a polite way of saying it. They just don't trust him. They think he doesn't hold to his word. They think he undercuts them. Mitch McConnell is seen on the other side as purely a power politician, somebody with no principles that will just do whatever is in his political interest. That does not make him unique on Capitol Hill. He's just particularly blatant about it. They just don't get along very well. They face all the pressures that we've been discussing from their own parties. There's more sorting out of Americans, so people live with their like-minded brethren, and there's just not a lot of crossover in their own constituencies. And they just don't like each other very much, and that's contributing to a lot of these hang-ups.
Can't they just get along? Well, we'll leave it there because we've come to the end of the hour. Thank you so much, David Mark, Editor-in-Chief of Politics. And thanks also to Ken Rudin, political junkie, former political junkie with Public Radio, now political junkie, I mean with NPR, now political junkie, and former political editor
for
NPR. I'll get it straight, Ken. Thank you. Thanks also to Heidi Presbella, who joined us earlier, who is a congressional reporter from Bloomberg, and H.D. Palmer, Deputy Director of External Affairs for the California Department of Finance. And thanks to all of you, because we wouldn't be here without you. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank Senior Editor Dan Zoll and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us from KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.